Hi, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm your host, Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Ernesto Bassi. He's the author of An Aqueous Territory, Sailor Geographies and New Granada's Trans-Imperial Greater Caribbean World. This is a book which challenges us to shift our geographic imaginary so they're more in tune with the ways that sailors and other historical actors perceive them in the 18th and 19th centuries. It's a fascinating read, due, among other things, to Bassi's strategy of seeking out political and intellectual projects that didn't happen, but still matter. Hi, Ernesto. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Alejandra. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a terrific book. Before we start talking about it, I wanted to talk a little bit about you. Can you tell us what's your background and how did you arrive at this concept of the trans-imperial Greater Caribbean World? How did you come to be a historian of this trans-imperial Greater Caribbean World?
Okay, so I guess I can start by saying that I came late to history, but not to the Caribbean. I have a BA in economics. I didn't like economics that much, so I shifted to history. I did an MA in history, and then I went for the PhD in history. But I didn't come late to the Caribbean because I am from Colombia. I am from northern Colombia, from a city called Barranquilla, and we Barranquilleros are proud of calling ourselves Caribbean, right? But this here I get more into the essence of how I came to the book and to a book that started as a dissertation, right? So I started my PhD thinking that I was going to do a sort of a local history of Caribbean Colombia, inspired by lots of great historians of Caribbean Colombia that have written many local histories that clearly position Caribbean Colombia within the Colombian nation, right? I was thinking that I wanted to do something different, to perhaps to position Caribbean Colombia in a larger Caribbean world. At an early stage in my PhD studies, I took a world history seminar, which really helped me to think transnationally and to think about connections and to think about many of the connections that are at the heart of my book. There was also another key moment I remember before beginning my PhD program, where I went to a meeting of the ACH, the Association of Caribbean Historians, that in Cartagena, Colombia, in 2005. And I remember during that meeting, there was sort of a running joke about this being the first time that the association meets outside the Caribbean, right? And to me, that was shocking because I have always thought of Cartagena as a very Caribbean city, right? But I guess I didn't have any sort of methodological tools to do something with that at that time. But then early in my PhD program in a graduate seminar on Caribbean history, I wrote a paper about the importance of being Caribbean, in which I reflected on that I call the Cartagena joke, and I guess between that, I guess that was the moment where I started to think more seriously about okay, what is it that makes Northern Colombia, or the northern provinces of what in the 18th century was the Viceroyalty of New Granada, what is it that makes this space, this area of the world, what is it that makes it that makes it part of the Caribbean?
So just pushing on the title a little bit more, because I think it's very rich and it really gives us a sense of the theoretical framework that you're working with. What do you mean by an aqueous territory? And after that, after you answer that question, I wanted to hear just a little bit about how you situate yourself within and against historiographic traditions. So which are the most important ones that you break wide open?
Okay, so the title, an aqueous territory, by the way, one of the most difficult words to pronounce that I have encountered. But the idea behind that is that in my description, in my explanation of this geographic space that I call the Trans-Imperial Greater Caribbean. I refer to it as an aqueous territory. And it's the idea behind it is that and this also goes a bit to the question on the historiographic traditions that I deal with. There is a way in which, in lots of the Atlantic history that I read, the sea appears as an interval between places, right? Historian John Gillies, I think, speaks of the sea as being a place, as being not just an interval between ports where the real history happens, right? And this was very clear to me in reading in the archive, in reading about sailors, that lots of action was happening in the high seas, right, on board ships. So far from being just an interval between ports, the sea was full of history, right? The sea is history, as poet Derek Walcott said, right? So that idea stuck with me. That idea so clear in Derek Walcott's poem became central to my idea of thinking of the sea as territory, thinking of the sea as place. But of course, it is not land. So I played there with words and came up with an aqueous territory. Also, a little bit based on the idea that there is a clear distinction between terrain and territory. In somewhat simplistic terms, terrain can be interpreted as associated with emptiness, while territory is full of signs and symbols that signal occupation, right?
Yeah. So which of the big historiographic traditions that you take on, which do you think is the most crucial?
So I would say it's Atlantic history and Caribbean history, both. In terms of Atlantic history, I was trained as a Latin American historian. Lots of my readings were in Atlantic history, right? And I guess in the last two decades, a number of historians have explored this idea that borders, that imperial borders in the Atlantic world were porous, fluid, hybrid, that permeability characterized these borders, but there was still a very I would call it a heavy historiographical baggage that depicts the Atlantic as a realm of separated empires, right? David Hancock, he speaks of a bit autocritically. He speaks of the of historians thinking of the Atlantic as if it was as if we were studying something that he calls an age of imperial self-sufficiency, right? And I wanted to explore the connections and the border crossings, and the archive was very helpful because the moment I started seeing following sailors, it was clear that they were crossing all sorts of borders. But there's also my take on Caribbean history and on the question, what is the Caribbean? And I felt that lots of the fantastic Caribbean history that I read was sort of thinking of the Caribbean in terms of the plantation, right? The idea that plantation societies in a way defined the Caribbean. An idea with which I actually agree, but I also like to think of several ways of defining a region, whether it is the Caribbean or Latin America. And I think this, thinking the Caribbean otherwise became an impetus for my project.
So one of the things you do that right away and drawing from the archive in really interesting ways. And one of the things that happens are that the maps, almost all of the maps in the book have the sea at the center. It's so interesting. One of the first ones has Kingston right at the center. So all of these things are all these ships are moving back and forth to Kingston, and you make a very compelling case for Kingston being at the center of a lot of transimperial networks. How does that come about?
So I think of Kingston in this second half of the 18th century, first two decades of the 19th century, especially after the 7 Years' War. I think of Kingston as the commercial capital of the world that I studied, as the commercial capital of the transimperial Greater Caribbean. And a very important thing here is that this idea of Kingston as a commercial capital of the transimperial Greater Caribbean emerged from the British archives, right? I approached the British archives with having previously done my sort of archival research in the Spanish archives, where there are lots of complaints about contraband trade with Kingston, right? But there are also many instances, especially in the after the 7 Years' War, and even more so after the American Revolution, where the Spanish archives show also a legal trade with Kingston. But the Spanish archives are also provide very incomplete information, in the sense that there's much more information for Cartagena than for other ports that I discovered, and there have been almost equally as important as Cartagena, ports like Santa Marta, Portobelo, Riohacha, which appear prominently in the first chapter of the book. But so then when I went to the British archives, I went through big tables of the shipping returns for Kingston, right? And the shipping returns for Kingston include tables that are about foreign vessels. And it turned out that after 1766, with the British passing the Free Ports Act and a series of laws that they passed starting in the 1766 and renew and expanded throughout the 18th century and the first two decades of the 19th century, those acts made it legal for foreign vessels to be in Kingston. So the trade that many times in the eyes of Spanish authorities was illegal and therefore didn't show up systematically in Spanish records was actually there in the British records. So I was able to work with tables of information about Spanish ships entering not only Kingston but also other free ports in Jamaica, like Montego Bay, Saint Lucia, but it was very, very clear that the great bulk, the vast majority of the trade was happening with Kingston. So the information was sort of there in the British archives, waiting for a historian to uncover.
So in some ways, the main character, well, in almost every way, the main characters of this book are the sailors. The ships came back and forth to Kingston and other ports, but it was the sailors that were on them that were doing all of this imagining of political boundaries in different kinds of ways. And you talk about them as engaging in everyday acts of region making, which I found a really intriguing phrase. And I wonder if you could tell us what you mean by that.
So what I mean by that is that so in a way I make the case that sailors with their constant mobility, with their back and forth, with their circulation, they create this region, right? They create this transimperial Greater Caribbean. They create it through their daily mobility. So this is the everyday acts of region making. For me, it was important. So following sailors allowed me to think of regions otherwise, right? Not just of the Caribbean, but of thinking deeply about what do we mean by region? How are regions defined, right? And I came to conclude that there are actually multiple ways of defining a region. I think the recent work of Stuart Schwartz and Sherry Johnson actually is a very good case for thinking about natural phenomena like hurricanes as region makers, right? Hurricanes happen in a certain area, right? In a certain there's a hurricane belt, right? Similarly, a similar idea is behind the idea of defining the Caribbean based on the plantation, right? The idea that plantation societies are key to defining the Caribbean. So here I wanted to let the people that I study or to let the sailors that I followed show me the world they inhabited, right? So their mobility became the key variable, so to speak, that defined my region, that defined my Caribbean, that defined my trans-imperial Greater Caribbean.
So the other set of actors that's very intriguing and also quite mobile are the indigenous actors. And you make a really compelling case for the Kuna and the Wayuu as cosmopolitan, technologically sophisticated, multilingual. How do you think we need to rethink the category and the role of indigenous people in the Greater Caribbean world and in the historiography?
In several ways. So there's a still dominant narrative of the Caribbean as an Indian-less space, right? So the narrative emerging from the early conquest period, early contact, which resulted in a vast, massive depopulation to the point of extinction, basically, right? And so therefore it seemed important to simply notice the presence of the indigenous people in the Caribbean, right? In a Caribbean that was a greater Caribbean, right? In the coasts, in the northern and the northeastern and northwestern coast of what is today Colombia. But it was not just the matter of seeing them, but it was also very interesting to see the actions in which they are engaged, because there tends to be, although there is fantastic recent study on indigenous interactions with Europeans that does away with this, but there is still a perhaps it's fair to call it a myth, right? Or an idea of indigenous people as being primitive, as being sort of fixed in time, and therefore it became crucial for me to see that the Wayuu of the Guajira Peninsula and the Kunas of the Darién were basically interacting with Europeans in their own terms. They were engaging in diplomatic relations. They were against the idea of indigenous people as being primitive. They were buying, selling, and using weapons. They were managing to remain unconquered, to repel all multiple Spanish attempts to enter their native territory by showing them that they had the more advanced British weapons, right? Spanish officers were complaining that that there was nothing they could do against the when they were up against the Wayuu, because the Wayuu were superior in terms of weapon. The Kunas, when they were engaging in diplomatic negotiations with Spanish authorities, or when they were engaging in trade with British authorities, or when they went to Jamaica, when they traveled to Jamaica to obtain weapons, or even to visit Jamaican officials, they were engaging with these supposedly superior European actors. The indigenous people were engaging with them in different languages. So it was very clear that the indigenous people were actors in their own right, that they were nowhere close to this notion of the primitive Indian, right?
Yeah. The last part of the book, the final three chapters, takes up several failed projects. And so before we discuss them in more detail, I wanted to ask you about this as a methodological approach. I was reminded of Londa Schiebiger's notion of tracing the production of ignorance, right? So, and I think that what you're doing is a little bit different, but it's a shared kind of interest in things that didn't come about. So I would love to hear you make your case for looking at things that didn't happen and why they matter.
So yes, I'm very interested in this idea because I think there is a type of history that I am very appreciative of, and it's a history that explains how we get to a certain point, right? The best known example that I can think of is the work of Benedict Anderson, right? It is an inquiry into the origins of nationalism, right? Reflections on the origin of nationalism. So it's an origins narrative, right? And I think origins narratives are very important. They explain how we get to a certain point. But at the same time, I'm interested in this project and in other projects, I'm interested in trying to see the past as the present for the people that I am studying, right? So if we approach the past as the present of those whose lives we're studying, we are going to see that they imagine potential futures, right? This is associated with what I called in the book the geopolitical imagination, right? The ways in which the people that I study interpreted their present and envisioned potential paths towards the future. This is what Manu Goswami calls the open-ended constellation of potential futures. Of course, many of these potential futures never end up happening. One could think of them as failed projects, right? But they were perceived as plausible, right? I have one chapter imagines the deals with the idea that certain merchants and planters in the province of Cartagena in what is today northern Colombia and merchants and planters in Kingston were imagining and to some extent were interested in the possibility of the British Empire turning south and potentially conquering the northern parts of South America, right? So that idea of looking of in a way of standing in the boots of those whose lives I'm studying to try to see to let them show me the potential futures that they imagine, to let them show them how they imagine that their very complicated present could evolve into a future, right?
Yeah. So Simon Bolivar's Jamaican letter is so canonized that it's easy to forget that he actually wrote it in a context, that there were things that he was trying to do and people that he was writing to. Can you talk a little bit about the context and why actually in the end it didn't work out for him?
So yes, Simon Bolivar is the subject here of my chapter five, Simon Bolivar's Caribbean Adventures. And so for me, the story that I want to tell in this chapter is a story of the wars of independence in Spanish America actually happening in the Caribbean, actually happening in ways that someone like Simon Bolivar predicted and not predicted and failed to predict, right? So he goes to Jamaica in May 1815. He's sort of expelled from New Granada, and he gets to Jamaica with the immediate idea of resuming the fight, right? With the help of British authorities and Jamaican authorities. He gets to Jamaica and he's very, very optimistic during perhaps his first 3 or 4 months in Jamaica. But by the end of 1815, he realizes that the British are going to stick with their neutrality policy. I guess luckily for him, right next to Jamaica in Haiti, Alexander Petion is offering help to Bolivar, right? There was a moment so this becomes the story of how with the help of Alexander Petion in Haiti, Bolivar was able to resume the fighting in South America, to resume the fighting that eventually led to the independence of Colombia and other countries in South America. But it was very important to me that in reading closely the letters of Bolivar, his logic emerged from those letters. There is a wonderful letter in which he tells his friend and collaborator, Louis Brion, who is from Curaçao, and Louis Brion ends up being the head of the first Colombian Navy. So Bolivar writes to him when at a moment in late 1815, when Brion is telling him, is urging Bolivar to come to Haiti. Bolivar tells Brion, I don't want to leave yet. I don't want to hurt this gentleman's sensibilities. And there I started to see Bolivar's sort of unwillingness or uncomfortability with Haiti's aid, right? It was in his mind, his plan was to get help from Britain, not from Britain, from the British Empire, not from the emerging Black Republic that was already seen with suspicious by him and others in the Atlantic world, right?
Yeah, and interestingly and ironically, the Haitians helped him out there because they didn't want to be seen as having helped him, so they had him keep quiet about the assistance that he was given, right? So there was a kind of strange confluence there of silencing.
Exactly. It worked out well for Bolivar. Petion asks Bolivar for a little favor of keeping it a secret. So it worked out for Bolivar. Of course, the secret was basically impossible to keep. Spanish agents were in Haiti. Spanish agents were well aware of what was going on, and there's also a very interesting diplomatic correspondence between Spanish officers and Petion, denying his aid to Bolívar, but Petion denying his aid to Bolívar at a point where the Spanish officers who had even sent spies into Haiti knew very clearly what had happened.
So you end the book with another kind of silencing, which is yet another also methodology, which I really enjoyed. And that was tracing this notion of what you call de-Caribbeanization in what was to become Colombia. How did that work? What's de-Caribbeanization and what's at stake?
So I think at stake here is a lot. At stake here is a reinterpretation of Colombia's national history. This last chapter is sort of the chapter in which I try to understand something that is actually central to Colombia's history and to the way in which Colombia's history has been narrated. There's this narrative of Colombia as a country of regions. In this narrative of the country of Colombia as a country of regions, the Caribbean is seen as left out. Is certainly perceived the Caribbean and the people of Caribbean Colombia and of Northern Colombia certainly perceived themselves or ourselves, because I include myself in that group, as being in a way left out, right? And so a couple of historians have written about the idea of La Nación Andina, the Andean nation, right? For me, in this chapter, it was clear that the Andean nation was a political project that had a history, right? So while some Colombian historians have written about this idea of an Andean nation, it has been written within a national framework. For me it was important to write this also as an Atlantic story, right? And the story of the de-Caribbeanization of the Colombian Republic and the creation of what I call an Andean Atlantic nation is central to the 19th century nation making strategy of the Andean Colombian elites, right? A way in which they built this Andean Atlantic nation, and it's a way that I explore in this chapter, a way in which they de-Caribbeanized the Caribbean nation was through maps. So I have this detailed section in which I analyzed over 60 maps, just looking for the name of the sea. And it turns out that throughout the 19th century, from the 1810s to the 1860s, it is a trajectory emerges in the way in which the sea to the north of the Republic was called, right? It shifted from Mar del Norte, North Sea, in the late colonial period, to a very brief moment, especially in British maps, where the name Caribbean Sea appeared, to a shift towards the 1850s and 1860s to calling it Oceano Atlántico. So I analyze Atlantic Ocean. I analyze a couple of geography textbooks that were written in the form of catechisms that were asking students, what are the limits, the boundaries of the Colombian nation? And the answer was, to the north, it limits with the Atlantic Ocean. My argument there is that being associated with the Atlantic instead of the Caribbean allowed Colombian nation makers to think of themselves as part of an Atlantic community of civilized nations instead of a Caribbean that was perceived as as black, as uncivilized, as barbaric, right? So that chapter offered me a good way to close the book because I think a thing that the book does is that it clearly shows this previously unknown history of strong connections with the Caribbean, right? The territory that later in the 19th century became Colombia. I show that in this book that in the late 18th and early 19th century was very much part of the Caribbean, right? The connections were really, really strong. Yet that is not part of the history that as Colombian I was taught, right? So that made it clear for me that a process that forgetting about these Caribbean connections was a process of de-Caribbeanization that I concluded in this chapter was a fundamental component of the nation making of Colombia's nation making project.
So the geographic imagination is really important part of this book. Do you think that you chose a place and a time of particularly rich imagined projects, or do you think that 20th century historians of elsewhere have some work to do in finding these failed projects and alternative geographies?
I think historians of the 20th century, of the 19th century, of the 18th century can find these alternative ways of seeing the world. I think it's important to rethink regions, to rethink world regionalization schemes, or to rethink area studies frameworks. Right? I think it is important to very consciously think of the world as those whose lives were studying it interpreted it, experienced it, and in doing so we let the subjects of our histories show us their world, right? But I do think this age of revolutions that I study, that many other Atlantic historians study, is very rich in terms of this geopolitical imagination and of this and of the existence of many ways in which the future was imagined, right? There's also this narrative that this era is characterized by a transition from colony to nation. Well, yes, that's what ended up happening, right? But the geopolitical imagination of the time, well, yes, many people were thinking about independence taking the form of the emerging of the emergence of a nation or of the emergence of a republic. But many other there were political imaginaries of monarchism throughout the 19th century. So it is this period is definitely rich in terms of the political projects that many actors envision. This period is also rich in terms of the shape that those political entities that different actors aspire to create could take, right? But I think the idea of letting the subjects we study show us their place in the world has applications beyond this period.
So I've taken up a lot of your time today. Before we close, though, I just wanted to ask, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
So I'm currently working on two projects, sort of the first project, the one in which I intend to focus my energies now. It's a I can describe it as retelling the history of the rise of capitalism from the shores of New Granada, right? From this, from the provinces of what is today northern Colombia, and this project comes out of lots of old and recent readings that I've been doing on the development of plantation societies in the Caribbean. More recently, I've been reading recent approaches to the rise of capitalism. I've been inspired by the work of John Tutino, by the work of Ken Pomeranz, and by their idea of the polycentric nature of the rise of capitalism, right? This idea that of capitalism not really emerging simply in Britain, but of different places in the world that different historians have identified as places where relations of production that resemble what we call capitalism were emerging in the late 18th century. So I think these stories are making it possible to construct a global history of the rise of capitalism, right? But in this global history of the rise of capitalism, I think several places, many places actually, like New Granada, like the what is now Colombia, right, are being left out, and they are being left out because they didn't become key sites of capitalist development, right? Yet it is very clear to me that in the late 18th century, political economists in New Granada, merchants in New Granada, imperial officers in New Granada, were thinking about ways of turning their provinces into key sites of production, into key sites of what we can call capitalist development, right? They were in conversation with Spanish imperial officers in Spain. They were in conversation and competition with planters in Cuba. Cuba ended up becoming the greatest sugar producer of the 19th century. New Granada didn't really become a sugar producer, but they certainly tried, right? So they were involved in these efforts that out of which comes what we can call the origins of capitalism. And then I'm also sort of starting to think of a project on Spanish speaking communities in Anglophone cities in the Americas. In the very early 19th century, I was recently reading the correspondence of a Cuban poet, Jose Maria Heredia, who lived in New York in between 1823 and 1825, and reading his correspondence was sort of an inspiration for me to try to uncover these communities of Spanish speakers that were emerging in different sites of the Americas. I've encountered Colombians in Port of Spain, Trinidad in the 1810s. Simón Bolívar and many others were in Kingston in the 1810s. So I've been sort of gradually accumulating information in different archives about a number of Spanish speakers that were living in different Anglophone cities in the U.S., but also in the Caribbean. And I want to reconstruct the lives of these communities.
So I can see traces of the first project and the branching out into a couple of different really interesting pursuits. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you, Alejandra. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and I hope you can join me next time.